Thank you very much. For those of you whom I haven't had the pleasure of meeting so far, I'm Paul LeClaire, the president of the greatest library in the world, the New York Public Library. And on behalf of Katie Maron, who's here, the wonderful chairman of the board of the library, and on behalf of all of our trustees, virtually half of whom are here today, with many with their spouses, and there's even one mother-in-law of a trustee who's here. On behalf of all of those individuals and our staff, I'm delighted to welcome you to the Celeste Bartos Forum this afternoon for the 27th Spring Luncheon at the New York Public Library. Like the library itself, this event gets better and better every single year, thanks to the dedication, the hard work, and the great generosity of every woman and man in this room, and many others. I'm delighted to begin my litany of thanks today by thanking the incomparable duo of trustees Joan Hardy Clark and Calvin Trillin, who have for the past 5 years been co-chairs of this event, and this year they've been joined by Heather Mnuchin and by Liz Peek as the great team that put this event together. With the help of these four absolutely splendid and hardworking co-chairs, they and you have produced $383,000 of new funds for books at the New York Public Library. That's a great, great goal. And even though we've all applauded them already, I would ask all of them to stand at this point. Joan, where are you? Joan, thank you. And Heather and Liz. Heather is here. And Liz, thank you. And Bud. I would also like to take a moment to thank our Book World Advisory Committee, made up of devoted friends of the library from the world of publishing, for their assistance again this year, as well as Simon & Schuster for the wonderful, irreverent design for today's program and invitations. And a very, very special thanks to Kathy Rayner. Kathy, where are you? Can you? Kathy's right here. These fabulous, witty, somewhat irreverent table decorations of the doing and the gift of Kathy. Another wonderful, wonderful gift of Kathy Rayner to the library. Thank you, Kathy. These are very good times, in spite of what one might think. These are very good times for libraries in New York City. This year, the New York Public Library will have 15 million visits to its 91 facilities, and we'll have another 25 million visits to the New York Public Library's website, with readers coming to us from everywhere in the world. And everything that all of those visitors receive at the library is for free. That's the remarkable story about this great place. And my sense is that people, you and others, are as generous to us because we, in turn, are so generous to the people who come to visit us and come to use our immense resources. The people who use our libraries, and especially the branch libraries, are people of very, very modest means. We now know through a recent survey that 60% of the users of our library come from families in which the family income is less than $50,000 a year. 60% of those who use the New York Public Library branches are members of minority groups. If you live in the Bronx, there is only one bookstore in the Bronx. One. There's a Barnes & Nobles in Co-op City, and you see it when you're going north on what becomes the New England Thruway. That's it. So if you're a person of modest means, as most people in the boroughs that we cover are, and you want a book, there's one place to get it. That's at a New York Public Library. Another interesting statistic, and a really important one for you all to know, is that in any given year, more people visit public libraries in New York City than visit all of the cultural institutions and all the sports teams combined. And the people who visit public libraries are residents of New York City. So if you care about the things that we care about, if you care about building human capital, if you care about building social capital, and if you care about building intellectual and cultural capital, libraries in New York City are the places that matter immensely in those tasks. And your support of this library is something that we, all the trustees who are here and all the staff who are here and all our patrons, are immensely grateful for. So hats off to you this year for being so generous, so understanding, so supportive. And keep one thing in mind as you go around town, libraries are relevant. If anybody says to you, are we still going to need libraries in 5 years because of the internet, because of Google, because of Barnes & Noble, and because of Starbucks, the answer is categorically yes. We need books, and we need libraries to hold those books. We need computers for the public, and so on and so forth. So stay with us, because we're in this for the long term. Our program today is entitled, Thank you very much. Our program today is entitled, A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Library, and we are fortunate to have as our host and moderator the unassumingly brilliant editor of The New Yorker and trustee of the New York Public Library, David Remnick. David will be introducing the readers here behind me who will be reading for us today, but I do want to take a moment to thank them for being so enormously generous in giving us, totally for free, their time and their talent for the lunch today. David Remnick is, without question, one of the leading figures in America's Republic of Letters. He became a staff writer at The New Yorker in 1992, and only 6 years later he became the editor of what all of us know is one of the single greatest magazines in the English language today. David is the author and the editor of a shelf of books, including, of course, Lenin's Tomb, which won the Pulitzer Prize for nonfiction, the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism, the library's own Helen Bernstein Prize for the best book published by an American journalist in that year. David, thank you for being so devoted to us, for always accepting our invitation to do something for the library, and for accepting to be our host this afternoon. Ladies and gentlemen, the great David Remnick.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thank you all for coming. And I want to thank the co-chairs, Joan and Heather and Liz and Bud Trillin. In 1992, I took a copy of A Farewell to Arms out of a branch library. A few years ago, my assistant told me that Paul LeClaire wanted to come to my office to visit me. And I thought that I was about to get busted in the most personal way. And he came to my office at The New Yorker, and I tried to divert his attention by trying to sell him a talking dog cartoon. He was not having it. And I think as a way for me to pay back for the copy of A Farewell to Arms, he asked me to be a trustee on the board. And I said, that's great, Paul, but I can't, how do I put this in this august company? I can't quite give to you what other trustees might be able to provide. And he said, you only have one role as a trustee, and your role as a trustee is if Bud Trillin can't make it, or if after one of his many eating tours of downtown causes him to have indigestion, you have to be the Toastmaster General of the New York Public Library. That's my role on the board, and I'm very proud to fulfill it today because Bud is one of our performers. Before we begin, I do want to say a very special thank you, and that is to Paul LeClaire and to Katie Marin. I know you're all aware that the New York Public Library not only has great relevance, it doesn't have to explain itself at all, but is going through a kind of radical revision while retaining its extraordinary core, but going through a kind of real estate cum intellectual cum property transformation that is requires enormous intellect, sense of the city, sense of every income level of the city, and it requires great humanity and imagination. And Paul LeClaire and Katie Marin have done extraordinary work, and I think they deserve a fantastic round of applause. If they were running the country instead of the current administration, I think we'd all be living in milk and honey and peace forever. Now, We have on the stage five of the funniest people in the English-speaking world. I know this for a fact because I'm a humor professional. I have a license in my wallet that says so. And we're going to begin with Jennifer Allen, who, among other things, you have the list of her books in your program. But one thing I do want to tell you that she has a one-woman show coming soon that will be called The Big Boot, and it'll be directed by James Lapine. So please welcome Jennifer Allen.
Very happy to be here. Can everybody hear? Am I? Okay, dope. This piece is for all the women over, say, 45 who are up in the middle of the night. I don't know any woman over 45 who isn't up in the middle of the night. It's just another one of those jokes our bodies play on us. So I guess this is for every woman in the room in her prime. I'm up. Are you up? If you added up all the hours I've spent awake in the middle of the night, it would come to years by now. 50 may be the new 40, but for the sleepless woman, 50 is the new 80. Thank you. That's a very good idea, but I already took a sleeping pill. I fell asleep right away. It's bliss, that drugged drifting off. But now I'm awake again. That always happens. I fall asleep, and then boom, 4 or 5 hours later, I wake up like it's my turn on watch, like I've just had a full night's sleep. But if I act as if I've just had a full night's sleep, if I get up and do things, I'll be pitiful tomorrow. I will confuse the TV remote with the cordless phone and try to answer it. I will not notice any of my typos. I will type pubic school this and pubic school that when I am sending an email about schools that are not private. Emails to people whose public schools I am looking at for my daughter. I will say, I saw a store at the Shelley. And then I will have to make one of those dumb Alzheimer's jokes. I could take another sleeping pill, but I worry about that. I worry about liking sleeping pills too much. Sleeping pills always make me think of Judy Garland. Poor Judy. It's funny about the name Judy, isn't it? No one names anybody Judy anymore. Do you ever see any 5-year-old Judys? But half the women I know are named Judy. You would probably be safe when meeting any woman over 50 just to say, nice to meet you, Judy. Most of the time, you would be right. I am going to lie here and fall asleep counting all the Judys I know. 13 Judys, including my husband's ex-wife, who's very nice, by the way. I'm still awake. Some people who knew my husband before I met him call me Judy. Hi, Judy, how are you, they say. I never correct them. Who can blame them when they know so many Judys? Although I do sort of hope that later they'll realize they have called me the wrong name and make note of what a nice person I must be not to have corrected them. I can't believe I called her Judy, and her husband's ex-wife is named Judy. She could have been really unpleasant about that. What a fine and self-restrained person she is. I'm going to try and be more like her. Are all my Judy friends up like me? Judy in Brooklyn, are you up? Judy on Amsterdam Avenue. Judy in Lincoln Towers. Judy in Morningside Heights. Judy on Riverside Drive. I'm here in my bed, imagining I can see all of you outside my window. I probably could see a few of you if you waved at me. One of my bedroom windows looks out on a nice-sized slice of the Upper West Side. I feel like the teacher in Romper Room when I was little. She used to hold a big magnifying glass the size of a tennis racket in front of her face so that it was between her and you. And she would say, I see Leslie and Barbara and Scott and Bruce and Judy. And I see Karen and Peter and Derek. I see them. I see all my Judys. And I see Martha and Angeline and Becky and Susie and Eden and Annie and Vicky and Sharon and Nancy and Ruth and Goldie and Wendy. I see them lying there in their 90s, their faces shiny with night cream. Some of us lie alone. Some of us lie next to another person who is enragingly sleeping like a log. How can these people next to us sleep so soundly? They snore, they shake their restless legs, syndrome legs all over their side of the bed. They mutter protests from the parts they are playing in their dreams. I didn't say Elmira! And it's not yours. They're making a regular racket, and yet they sleep on. Sleepless friends, I am thinking about you. Ginny, did you decide what to do about day camp for your grandchildren this summer? Martha, what are you reading to fall back to sleep? Will you call me tomorrow and tell me about it? Mimi, are you up thinking about who you haven't had lunch with lately? You are 86 years old. That is 237 in wakeful woman years. Congratulations for hanging in there. Sometimes I fall asleep to the television. And this is a strange thing. No matter what I have fallen asleep watching, when I wake up in the middle of the night, what's on is Girls Gone Wild. I never turn the channel to Girls Gone Wild, I promise. It's just on. Oh my goodness, those girls must sleep well when they finally do sleep. I have to change the channel right away when Girls Gone Wild comes on because I always think about the girls' mothers and that upsets me. I worry about their mothers up in the middle of the night, waking up to Girls Gone Wild. You know, that looks just like Melanie. Oh my God. Oh, look, Law and Order's on. I've seen this episode, of course. Do they run the same ones over and over? Or is it just that I've seen every single one there is? What a scary thought. Fortunately, I never remember what happens after the opening scene when they find the dead person, so I can watch them all over again. That was a good one. Although one day, maybe there will be a teenager on the show who isn't a psycho killer. I'm still awake. Friends, are you all still up? It seems inefficient for us somehow all to be awake separately. Wouldn't it be great if we could pool all our individual little tributaries of wakeful energy into one mighty Mississippi and then harness it like a WPA project, like the Hoover Dam? We could power something. We could light up Manhattan. We could light up Manhattan and have a huge party for all the women who are awake. I should read. Reading is too hard for the dead of night. Reading has too many words in it, including words I might not know. If I read a word I don't know, I'll feel compelled to scrawl it on whatever piece of paper is by my bed, and then hope it is my good fortune to be able to read my writing tomorrow, and to remember to look up the word in the dictionary. If I'm too lazy to write down the word, I'll have to make a decision about whether to dog-ear the page. Bad reader citizenship. And I don't want the burden of that choice now, not in the middle of the night. Also, I know that even if I do look up a word tomorrow, I won't remember the definition next week. I keep looking up the same words over and over. Fungible. Heliotrope. How many times am I supposed to look up heliotrope? I used to remember the definitions, but I haven't for years. I still know a lot of words, though. Cleave is a funny word, because it means to sunder. And strangely, it also means to stick to. Ouster is a funny word. Ouster means the act of getting rid of someone, but it also means the person who does the getting rid of. Who really should be the ousterer? Ooh, timorous, that's a funny word. Timorous means timid. Why not just say timid? Timmy was the name of the boy in Lassie, the television show. The theme song for the show was melancholy, shockingly so. It made you yearn, it made you homesick, even as you watched it in your own home. When was Lassie on? Bonanza was on Thursday nights, Sunday nights, I think. There were three brothers in Bonanza, Adam, Hoss, and Little Joe. My sister was quiet and liked Adam the best. My brother wore clothes from the Husky department, so he liked Hoss, who was overweight, the best. I liked Little Joe because I was the youngest and so was Little Joe. Also, I was a scamp and cute. Like Little Joe. I am still awake. Only now everything is sort of blending together. It's the time of night when I think I might finally be losing my mind for good. The theme song from Lassie is blending into the Brownie song, the one about I've got something in my pocket that belongs across my face, about a great big brownie smile. Where's my other older daughter's Girl Scout badge sash? Why didn't the younger one ever do Girl Scouts? What's in that pot roast recipe besides a cinnamon stick and horseradish? What was my old zip code when I lived on 3rd Avenue? Why didn't I file that expense account worth $1,000 10 years ago? Instead of going crazy, maybe I'll just lie here and regret things. Let's see. Can I really blame the really big mistakes on others? Didn't they fail me? Didn't they provoke me? Didn't they drive me to it? Didn't they just really strain my patience? No, face it. You have some things to regret. Now you have to sit with it, as Buddha would say, or in your case, lie with it. Not exactly the path to slumberland. Here's the question. Have you done the love thing? The unconditional love thing? Have you done it with your children? You could do better. And the person lying next to you, the one with the jitterbugging, restless legs, have you done the unconditional love thing with him? Really? Even after all these years? You better get busy. Oh, look. The city sky is turning from purplish black to brown. It's going to be daylight. Dawn. How are you, Dawn? How's my girl? As long as you're up, I might as well get up, too. We can keep each other company.
The next entry in your program is Noam Baumbach, who unfortunately couldn't make it with us today. He couldn't be here. He had a family emergency. I'm sure everything will be okay, but he just couldn't come by. I'm proud to say the next reader is a frequent contributor to The New Yorker. In about a week and a half, you'll see a piece in which the part of Oprah is played by Ayman al-Zawahiri, the number two of al-Qaeda, in which he answers questions by email. Andy is everywhere. He is on CNN, he is on the internet, and he has a wonderful website, and he has a terrific book called Republican Playbook, Andy Borowitz.
Thank you. Wow, Jenny Allen is a tough act to follow, I gotta say. Let's hear for Jenny. That was amazing. You know, when the library asked me to do this event, I said I was so honored I would do it for free, and it turns out they had the exact same idea. So. So great when you're on the same page like that. I'm just. But what a meal. Can you believe this spread and free? I can't believe it. I'm coming back tomorrow. I mean, if I had known that they served food free every day at the library, this wouldn't have been my first visit today. I would have come long before today. That was interesting. I was interested in hearing Paul LeClaire say that more people have visited the library than all the other cultural institutions combined. Take that, Metropolitan Museum of Art. Losers. I hope to go someday to that place as well. Well, it was a great honor to be introduced by David Remnick. As David pointed out, I do write for The New Yorker quite a bit. David may not remember this, but actually my first humor piece for The New Yorker was in 1998, on the very week that David took over as editor. So we started together, and we're leaving together. We've decided, because The New Yorker is a great magazine, and a lot of people read it, but not as many as go to the library. You with me on that? Okay, good. Well, now that I've pretty much alienated everyone in the room, I thought I'd begin. In addition to writing for The New Yorker, I sometimes write humor for the op-ed page of The New York Times under the pen name Paul Krugman. So you know my work. That's good. And I wrote a piece in the Times this past Saturday. I was responding to something in the news, which is that, as many of you know, this is the time of year where colleges are sending out their acceptance letters or rejection letters. And especially at some Ivy League colleges like Harvard, there have been so many applications that Harvard's been put in the bad position of having to say no to some Harvard legacies. And even double legacies, parents, kids whose parents both went to Harvard and maybe contributed a lot of money to Harvard. So with that in mind, I wrote this. This is a letter from the Office of Admissions at Harvard College to a double legacy applicant of the class of 2012. Here at Harvard's Office of Admissions, we have some very exciting news for you. While your SAT scores and grade point average fall below the threshold for acceptance to Harvard's class of 2012, your Harvard parents' dogged participation in our annual fundraising appeals, including their generous contributions to Harvard's recombinant DNA lab and IMAX Theater, have gained you admission to a unique new program called Legacy Plus. With Legacy Plus, you, the Harvard double legacy, will enjoy all the perks of students who actually got into Harvard, except for the education part. As a Legacy Plus attendee, you will live on the Harvard campus for the next 4 years in special Legacy Plus housing adjacent to historic Harvard Yard. You will walk, talk, and on four special common nights a year, dine with real Harvard undergraduates. What will you and your fellow Legacy Plus enrollees be doing while the actual Harvard class of 2012 is going to lectures, choosing majors, and taking exams? A better question would be, what won't you be doing? With a jam-packed schedule of specially organized Legacy Plus clam bakes, pub crawls, and repeat visits to Boston's fabled Freedom Trail, you won't have time to think about all those classes you won't be taking. And the benefits of Legacy Plus don't end in June 2012, when, in a ceremony scheduled to coincide with Harvard commencement, you will receive an authentic-looking Harvard College Certificate of Participation. This diploma-like document, produced by an expensive laser printer, allows you to tap into Harvard's old boy network of jobs, fellowships, and government positions that have been turned down by actual Harvard graduates. Some of the additional perks of Legacy Plus include official Harvard tuition bill, identical to those paid by parents of the Harvard class of 2012. Permission to root for the Harvard football, hockey, and lacrosse teams, complimentary tickets to swim meets. 15% discount on Legacy Plus Harvard insignia items, including a car window sticker reading, "My child is at Harvard." Special Legacy Plus don't ask, don't tell policy regarding your use of the words Harvard College on your resume. Invitations to Legacy Plus class reunions, including such events as a Boston Pops concert attended by the actual Harvard class of 2012, which will you will view from your hotel via closed circuit TV. And finally, the greatest privilege of all, a lifelong relationship with Harvard's dedicated network of fundraising cold callers. So join us, won't you? Take advantage of this rare opportunity by wiring funds today. Prices double after May 1st. Remember, that's Legacy Plus, the class without the classes. Thank you very much.
Sandy Frazier has been writing for The New Yorker for quite a long time, and one of my favorite pieces of his well, after Kimberly Solzhenitsyn's social schedule, is a piece that begins in the following way. Barbara Lee Diamonston Spielvogel, Barbara Lee Diamonston Spielvogel. It's done as a poem, and it's repeated 6 or 7 times. I've been waiting all my life to do this. Sandy Frazier, Barbara Lee Diamonston Spielvogel. Table 3. Sandy Frazier's new book is called The Lamentations of the Father. It's one of the funniest humor collections I've read in a very, very long time. Please welcome Sandy.
Well, it's nice to meet you, Barbara. I love this library. I've worked doing research in the main reading room for hundreds of hours, or thousands maybe. And when I was doing a book about my family, I spent a lot of time up there reading religious books. I was writing about my ancestors, and a lot of them had been ministers. And I found out what kind of books they were reading back in the 19th century. Well, of course, you can find them here in the public library. You want to read Fox's Book of Martyrs, it's here. And as I was reading them and doing this research, I had young kids. My kids were just little at the time that I was doing this. And after a certain amount of time reading all these religious books and participating in the socialization of my children, I came up with this piece, which is the title piece of my new collection. The full title of it is Laws Concerning Food and Drink, Household Principles, Lamentations of the Father. Of the beasts of the field and of the fishes of the sea and of all foods that are acceptable in my sight, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the hoofed animals broiled or ground into burgers, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the cloven-hoofed animals, plain or with cheese, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the cereal grains, of the corn and of the wheat and of the oats and of all the cereals that are of bright color and unknown provenance, you may eat, but not in the living room. Of the quiescently frozen dessert and of all frozen after-meal treats, you may eat, but absolutely not in the living room. Of the juices and other beverages, yes, even of those in sippy cups, you may drink, but not in the living room, neither may you carry such therein. Indeed, when you reach the place where the living room carpet begins, of any food or beverage, there you may not eat, neither may you drink. But if you are sick and are lying down and watching something, then you may eat in the living room. Laws when at table. And if you are seated in your high chair or in a chair such as a greater person might use, keep your legs and feet below you as they were. Neither raise up your knees nor place your feet upon the table, for that is an abomination to me. Yes, even when you have an interesting bandage to show, your feet upon the table are an abomination and worthy of rebuke. Drink your milk as it is given you. Neither use on it any utensils, nor fork, nor knife, nor spoon, for that is not what they are for. If you will dip your blocks in the milk and lick it off, you will be sent away. When you have drunk, let the empty cup then remain upon the table, and do not bite it upon its edge, by your teeth hold it to your face, in order to make noises in it sounding like a duck, for you will be sent away. When you chew your food, keep your mouth closed until you have swallowed, and do not open it to show your brother or your sister what is within. I say to you, do not so, even if your brother or your sister has done the same to you. Eat your food only. Do not eat that which is not food, neither seize the table between your jaws, nor use the raiment of the table to wipe your lips. I say again to you, do not touch it, but leave it as it is. And though your stick of carrot does indeed resemble a marker, draw not with it upon the table, even in pretend, for we do not do that, that is why. And though the pieces of broccoli are very like small trees, do not stand them upright to make a forest, because we do not do that, that is why. Sit just as I have told you, and do not lean to one side or the other, nor slide down until you are nearly slid away. Heed me, for if you sit like that, your hair will go into the syrup. And now behold, even as I have said, it has come to pass. Laws pertaining to dessert. For we judge between the plate that is unclean and the plate that is clean, saying first, if the plate is clean, then you shall have dessert. But of the unclean plate, the laws are these. If you have eaten most of your meat and two bites of your peas, with each bite consisting of not fewer than three peas each, or in total, six peas, eaten where I can see, and you have also eaten enough of your potatoes to fill two forks, both forkfuls eaten where I can see, then you shall have dessert. But if you eat a lesser number of peas, and yet you eat the potatoes, still you shall not have dessert. And if you eat the peas, yet leave the potatoes uneaten, you shall not have dessert, no, not even a small portion thereof. And if you try to deceive by moving the potatoes or peas around with a fork that it may appear you have eaten what you have not, you will fall into iniquity. And I will know, and you shall have no dessert. On screaming. Do not scream, for it is as if you scream all the time. If you are given a plate on which two foods you do not wish to touch each other are touching each other, your voice rises up even to the ceiling while you point to the offense with the finger of your right hand. But I say to you, scream not, only remonstrate gently with the server that the server may correct the fault. Likewise, if you receive a portion of fish from which every piece of herbal seasoning has not been scraped off, and the herbal seasoning is loathsome to you and steeped in vileness, again I say, refrain from screaming. Though the vileness overwhelm you and cause you a faint unto death, make not that sound from within your throat, neither cover your face nor press your fingers to your nose. For even now I have made the fish as it should be. Behold, I eat it myself, yet do not die. Concerning face and hands, cast your countenance upward to the light and lift your eyes to the hills, that I may more easily wash you off. For the stains are upon you. Even to the very back of your head there is rice thereon. And in the breast pocket of your garment and upon the tie of your shoe, rice and other fragments are distributed in a manner wonderful to see. Only hold yourself still. Hold still, I say. Give each finger in its turn for my examination thereof, and also each thumb. Lo, how iniquitous they appear. What I do is as it must be, and you shall not go hence until I have done. Various other laws, statutes, and ordinances. Bite not, lest you be cast into quiet time. Neither drink of your own bathwater, nor of bathwater of any kind, nor rub your feet on bread, even if it be in the package, nor rub yourself against cars, nor against any building, nor eat sand. Leave the cat alone, for what has the cat done? That you should so afflict it with tape. And hum not that humming in your nose as I read, nor stand between the light and the book. Indeed, you will drive me to madness, nor forget what I said about the tape. Complaints and lamentations. Oh, my children, you are disobedient. For when I tell you what you must do, you argue and dispute hotly, even to the littlest detail. And when I do not exceed, you cry out and hit and kick, yes, and even sometimes do you spit and shout stupid head and other blasphemies, and hit and kick the wall and the molding thereof when you are sent to the corner. And though the law teaches that no one shall be sent to the corner for more minutes than he has years of age, Yet I would leave you there all day, so mighty am I in anger. But upon being sent to the corner, you ask straight away, can I come out? And I reply, no, you may not come out. And again you ask, and again I give the same reply. But when you ask again a third time, then you may come out. Hear me, my children, for the bills they kill me. I pay and pay again, even to the 12th time in a year, and yet again they mount higher than before. For our health, that we may be covered, I give 1,420 talents 12 times in a year, but even this covers not the 1,500 deductible for each member of the family within a calendar year. And yet for ordinary visits, we still are not covered, nor for many medicines, nor for the teeth within our mouths. Guess not at what rage is in my mind, for surely you cannot know. For I will come to you at the first of the month and at the 15th of the month with the bills and a great whining and moan. And when the month of taxes comes, I will decry the wrong and unfairness of it and mourn with wine and ashtrays and rend my receipts. And you shall remember that I am, before, after, and until you are 21. Hear me then and avoid me in my wrath, O children of me.
Who knew that the Old Testament God was a Protestant from Ohio? Bud Trillin has done everything for The New Yorker. He began by writing about the civil rights movement in the mid-60s. He's written humor pieces. He's written more barbecue pieces than there are barbecue joints in the world. And he is certainly the only man that I know of who has written an entire novel about parking in New York City. He is also known in my household by my children as the only man who eats more fried crap than Daddy, Calvin Trillin.
Thank you. Thank you, David. I really wasn't here to boast, but many people think that that novel is the first parking novel ever written. There hasn't been a big bandwagon effect, so I think it's fair to say it's the only novel. And thank you, David. Thank you for the job you do at The New Yorker. When David was made the editor of The New Yorker, The New York Times said he grew up reading The New Yorker, and I said, no, no, it's better than that, David, because your father was a dentist. You grew up reading old New Yorkers. This is a piece that is my version of what I think is a good trend in American newspapers, a correction column. Corrections. January 14th. Because of an editing error, an article in Friday's theater section transposed the identifications of two people involved in the production of Waiting for Bruce, a farce now in rehearsal at the Rivoli. Ralph W. Murtaugh, Jr., a New York attorney, is one of the play's financial backers. Hillary Murtaugh plays the ingenue. The two Murtaughs are not related. At no time during the rehearsal visited by the reporter did Ralph Murtaugh sashay across the stage. March 25th. Because of some problems in transmissions, there were several errors in yesterday's account of a public forum held by the Women's Civic Forum of Rye on the role played by slovenliness in domestic violence. The moderator of the forum, Laura Murtaugh, should not have been identified as an unmarried mother of eight. Mrs. Murtaugh, the president of the Women's Civic Forum, is married to Ralph W. Murtaugh, Jr., an attorney who practices in Manhattan. The phrase, he was raised with the hogs and he lived like a hog, was read by Mrs. Murtaugh from the trial testimony of an Ohio woman. It did not refer to Mrs. Murtaugh's own husband. Mr. Murtaugh was raised in New York. April the 4th. An article in yesterday's edition on the growing contention between lawyers and their clients should not have used an anonymous quotation referring to the firm of Newton, Murtaugh, and Clayton as ambulance-chasing jackals without offering the firm an opportunity to reply. Also, the number of hours customarily billed by Newton Murtaugh Partners was shown incorrectly on a chart accompanying the article. According to a spokesman for the firm, the partner who said he bills clients for 35 or 40 hours on a good day was speaking ironically. There are only 24 hours in a day. The same article was an error as to the first name and the background of one of the firm's senior partners. The correct name is Ralph W. Murtaugh, Jr. There is no one named Hillary Murtaugh connected with the firm. Ralph W. Murtaugh, Jr. has at no time played an ingenue on Broadway. April 29th. Because of a computer error, the early editions on Wednesday misidentified the person arrested for a series of armed robberies of kitchen supply stores on the west side of Manhattan, the so-called Pesto Bandit. The person arrested was Raymond Collum, 22, of Queens. Ralph W. Murtaugh III, 19, of Rye, should have been identified as the runner-up in the annual Squash for Kids charity squash tournament in Rye rather than as the alleged robber. May 18th. Because of an error in transmission, a four-bedroom brick colonial house on Weeping Bend Lane in Rye, owned by Mr. and Mrs. Ralph W. Murtaugh, Jr., was incorrectly listed in Sunday's real estate section as being on the market for $17,500. The house is not for sale. June the 21st. In Sunday's edition, the account of a wedding that took place the previous day at St. John's Church in Rye was incorrect in a number of respects. The cause of the errors was the participation of the reporter in the reception. This is in itself against the policy of this newspaper and should not have occurred. Jane Murtaugh was misidentified in two mentions. She was neither the mother of the bride nor the father of the bride. She was the bride. It was she who was wearing a white silk gown trimmed in tulle. The minister was wearing conventional ministerial robes. Miss Murtaugh should not have been identified on second mention as Mrs. Perkins, since she will retain her name and since Mr. Perkins was not, in fact, the groom. There were 8 bridesmaids, not 38. Their dresses were blue, not glued. The bridegroom's name is not Franklin Marshall. His name is Emery Barnswell, and he graduated from Franklin and Marshall College. Mr. Barnswell never attended Emory University, which in any case does not offer a degree in furniture stripping. Mr. Barnswell's ancestor was not a signer of the Declaration of Independence and was not named Hector Boom Boom Bondini. The name of the father of the bride was inadvertently dropped from the article. He is Hillary Murtaugh. Thank you.
Thank you all for coming, and thank you all for your generosity. Have a good day.